It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Some good news. Good news. CDC saying that fully vaccinated people, mostly, you can go maskless. And this will make the anti-mask people very happy because now they can lie to us and say, no, I'm fully vaccinated. See, I don't have a mask on. Yeah. See, this is where we're going to go now. And look, I don't care about them. The reality is this is smart. Get us away from the masking a little bit. Common sense, they're saying, though. And again, this is one of those struggles for we the people. When you're in large areas, combined, you know, kind of packed in, you know, wear the mask. Protect yourself. Common sense. Taking the kids to see Green Day over the summer. We've got tickets. We're going. We're going to wear a mask while we're there. Plan on going to see the Broncos in Pittsburgh and probably in Cleveland, too. Going to wear a mask. Just a little bit. A little bit of protection. And again, this goes back to something, you know, I've been talking about through this entire process. Right when the pandemic began, before we knew anything about it, I went to my family doctor, had a checkup. Family doctor says, don't know what it is, but here's what we know. Here's the playbook. Here's what you do during pandemic time. Here's what you do with virus. Stay away from each other, wash your hands, wear a mask. Simple. They should have made him in charge of all this because he was very, very honest about it. Simple. It's all we can do. That's all we can do until there's a vaccine, until there's a therapeutic to help you get through it. It's all you can do. There's nothing else. There's no magic cure. There's no shoving lights up your behind or drinking bleach. None of that. Common sense. And the other bit of advice he gave, he said, look, 6 months after they say it's okay, 6 months after they say it's okay to go maskless, he said there's going to be at least one guy who's going to be wearing his mask. And he said it's going to be me. And that makes sense to me. So now officially, my good doctor, this I believe is the day, 6 months from today, wearing the mask. Because they're saying, hey, you don't have to. Still going to do it for the next 6 months. Because, one, I trust my doctor. I trust him full-heartedly. But two, just common sense. We're going to go into large crowds. We're going to get back into that. We're going to protect ourselves. Sane, rational, lucid, all of that. Also, some other good news. The vaccinations will begin for children 12 to 15. The CDC did give the green light for that, and we'll see where it goes. There's the Pfizer two-dose vaccine that's already been approved for 16 and older. We're now looking for the 12 to 15 group where both of my kids fit. My two youngest kids, that's where they fit. And look, I'm looking forward to them getting that so we can go to the concerts and we can go to football games in the fall. Looking forward to getting back to the kind of things that we did as a family, the kind of things that we did, just me and the kids. So looking forward to that. Also, some other good news. Both presidents of each of the two teachers unions, the NEA, National Education Association, Becky Pringle over there, and AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten over there, have both said, come fall time, swing the doors open. We're going to embrace bringing kids back to school full time and get back on track in the fall, as I've been saying for the longest time. Stop with this nonsensical fighting right now. Now, not the time. In the fall, we're gonna be all right. You get the kids vaccinated, smart, sane, rational, thoughtful. I'm all in favor of it because, to be honest, it was my idea to begin with. So there is that. And here's the thing. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this stuff out. Again, you go back and you talk to people you trust, like I did with my family doctor, and. And if they're smart, they're going to lay it out in very stark terms. And my guy did. He said, look, this is all we can do. There's no magic pill to this stuff. This is the playbook. And the fact that the Trump administration didn't do it right from the start, knowing what it is, because, look, they knew. There's nothing going to convince me that they didn't know that this was the playbook. This was it. This is all there is. It's all there's ever been. And to say that, well, you know, it'll be gone, you know, a couple days. We're closing in on, what, 600,000 people dying from this? All because we couldn't do common sense, simple things. And we had an administration who kept denying that it was real and doing, at the very beginning, doing actual harm instead of good. And look, a CDC that was, you know, dropped the ball right from the start. There were a lot of failures here. And a lot of it had to do with going back to the former guy. Nobody wanted to step on the former guy's toes. Nobody wanted to feel the wrath of the former guy. And this is where we are. Now, you know, good news. The Biden administration has done very well. In fact, his approval rating in handling the virus, you know, last time I saw it was, you know, pushing 80%, which is, wow. That means that some Trump supporters had to go, yeah, he's doing an okay job. There had to be a few. So there is that. So I'm happy to hear that. Good news. So we're going to start the day off with a little bit of good news. Now, let's get into the crazy, because there is plenty of crazy. But we're going to start with Georgia Republican Representative Andrew Clyde, who has been all over the news today. And look, this isn't, for listeners of this program, you know none of this is new. I know a lot of the news media is now, oh my goodness, they're trying to normalize what happened on January 6th. I've been talking about this for a while. But Representative Clyde had this to say. There was no insurrection. To call it an insurrection is a bold-faced lie. Watching the TV footage of those who entered the Capitol and walked through Statuary Hall showed people in an orderly fashion staying between the stanchions and ropes, taking videos and pictures. You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January 6th, you'd think it was a normal tourist visit. And I saw that little extra at the end. Because, look, they've been all saying, you know, January 6th wasn't what you saw it was. You know, it wasn't as bad as it looked. You know, these were good people on both sides. Even the ones who were smashing the windows and all that. And, you know, my mind went, when I saw this, it, you know, looked like any normal tourist visit day. And I'm going, you know what? I've been on some of these tourist visits. I've done some of this stuff. I've lobbied in the halls of the Capitol. I don't remember ever seeing anyone drop trow and take a dump in the middle of the hall. And then I don't remember people taking it and wiping it on the walls. I don't remember that in a normal visit. But this time someone decided it was important to defecate on the floor. And someone, I guess, came along and wiped it all over the place. Good for them. I know the excitement. They couldn't hold it in. They just had to let it out. And every day, you know, legislators are being rushed off to some corner bathroom somewhere where they're cowering in fear because there are people outside that want to kill them. Yeah, that happens every day during tourist days. Absolutely. And every day there's someone out there building a gallows to hang the vice president. That happens, oh, 4 or 5 times a week at least. This is what they want us to believe. You know, hey kids, we're going to take the kids on down to see the Washington Monument. We'll go over to the Jefferson, and maybe we'll kill a policeman or two. It happens all the time. It's on the agenda. On the agenda. That's what they want us to believe. And what it is, really, honestly and truthfully, is classic abuser talk. This is the classic wife beater talk. I would not be surprised if this guy's a wife beater. Wouldn't be surprised at all. Because this is what they do. Oh, well, it wasn't that bad. Oh, well, you know, they deserved it, those Democrats. They vacillate between the, it wasn't as bad, it wasn't so bad. Well, you know, you were asking for it. The Dems made us do it. Promise not to do it again. Until, of course, next time. And this is where this weird kind of world that we're in right now, because you've got a major media machine out there parroting this stuff. It wasn't so bad. These were good God-fearing Americans just lobbying their representatives. Yeah, they were stabbing the cops with the flagpole, and they were smashing windows, and they were, again, defecating on the floor, urinating on desks, stealing computers, tearing up papers, emptying cabinets. It happens every day. All the time. It happens all the time. And they want you to believe that this is normal. And in their world, this is okay. This is normal. This is what they want to be normal. If something that they, if they don't like it, they're going to smash it. They're going to come for you. And they want you to be in fear. What's interesting to me is, I wonder, and this is where if I were a Democratic representative, there's part of me where if I'm in those halls and my Republican colleagues are there, you know, the ones who refuse to wear a mask while they're confined in an area, cowering from the mob. There's part of me that goes, no, this is, we vote these people out of the safety, and we push them out into the crowd. I got to tell you, I wish one of them would have had the courage to step out there and go, hey, stop it. I wish one of them, I would have loved to have seen what would have happened to them. Because they stoked this fire. They built this monster. They pushed these people into this, them and Dear Leader. And now one of the only people who's talking out against Dear Leader, they threw her out of leadership. And again, I don't care about Liz Cheney at all. She, in my view, is a horrible, horrible legislator with terrible, terrible ideas. Her policy ideas are horrible just because she won't out and out lie and buy into the fantasy that somehow Dear Leader won doesn't make me jump on her side. I say, good, at least you're honest. I still think you're a horrible legislator. And speaking of horrible legislator, because look, they've canceled Liz Cheney, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's aces. They love her. In fact, the story, again, another one of those stories getting attention from yesterday, evidently MTG, Marjorie Taylor Greene, actually stalked down and attempted to accost AOC Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The kind of things that she did to that kid, that David Hogg kid. You why don't you care about America? You know, what's wrong with you? Why do you support terrorists? Why do you breathe air? You know, crazy stuff. Because she needs the feedback, because again, this is the abuser stuff. The only way she gets attention and the love that she needs from the crazy side is to get worse and worse and worse. And good on AOC for ignoring her. Just going, you know what? Not getting into this with you. You are so nuts. Just not going to do it. Now, I'll tell you, my first reaction when I saw this story is, I had wished that AOC would have just turned around and popped her right between the eyes. But that's what they want, because that's what they understand. And then that gives them the ability to say, see, bad people on both sides. When the reality is that this is who they are. This kind of craziness, this kind of insanity. And what we're witnessing is the normalization of the worst behavior and the worst abuses under the guise of some kind of bizarre patriotism. That somehow this is the new American way to stand up for yourself. Threats and intimidation and insurrection. There was a letter the other day that went out by the 1-6ers. Proud, patriotic Americans who aren't going to back down because we're calling them what they are, insurrectionists and terrorists. They, while in prison, singing, happy, organizing, Evidently, our 1-6ers, and there's a bunch of them that are being held in detention for trial. Evidently, every day they say the national anthem. They recite the Pledge of Allegiance. They're singing loud and proud the anthem there. It's a cult, really, because they've got their ritual. They've got their symbols. They've got their icons. And they got their cult-like leaders, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, to be honest, I think you could find someone smarter, someone better, someone more interesting, other than someone who's going to run down the hall screaming, "Yeah, why do you hate America?" Have a better argument, maybe. But that's all they've got. And this is the weird thing to me, because I keep coming back to this moment of, we've got real problems in this country. We've got real issues that need to be addressed. There's nothing coming from the Republican Party, and they're not going to help. There are no votes coming from them. There's no help. There's no policy. There's nothing. You hear people say, "Well, we want to work bipartisan." How can you have a bipartisan solution to something when one of the political parties is Fruit Loops? How can you have a real solution when you've got a Marjorie Taylor Greene or a Matt Gaetz or a Lauren Boebert? How can you possibly get things done? And that's always been my mantra. I got to get things done. We've got real problems. We've got families who are suffering. We've got kids who are going to bed hungry. We got veterans who are homeless. We've got bridges that got massive cracks in them. And who knows what kind of danger that could have been. We've got real problems. And yet what we get is a circus. We get a freak show. We get Marjorie Taylor Greene and the cabal. So I go back to Republicans. If there are any of you who are sane and lucid and rational, take what's left of your flaming party. Take what's left of the spiraling into insanity party and move it somewhere back. I'm not even asking anywhere near the sane line, just going in that direction at this point. Something. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm really, there are days where you go, "Really?" And this is one of them. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day workers at Tolteca Foods in Richmond, California, went out on strike. Many were undocumented Mexican women who helped organize the plant in 1969. In his book, The Revolutionary Imaginations of Greater Mexico, historian Alan Aledo Gomez states that the women had grown increasingly frustrated with the lack of union response regarding speed-ups, immigration raids, discretionary firings, substandard wages and unsafe working conditions, and began to look elsewhere for support. They reached out to the organization CASA, which provided legal and social services for undocumented immigrants. The women decided to strike without authorization from the Contra Costa Labor Council. They packed the council's emergency meeting, where they put their scarred bodies on display to attest to the dangerous and abusive working conditions and poor wages. Just as the council sanctioned the strike, workers learned the company started removing machinery from the factory. They packed the picket lines to stop the trucks from taking out the equipment. The first driver stopped. The second plowed through several women. The strike committee won an injunction to prevent the removal of equipment, and after 3 weeks, workers won their demands. Gomez argues the strike was important for several reasons. It demonstrated that a large female and undocumented workforce could organize and win a strike against a transnational company at a moment when unions were increasingly under attack. They built a rank-and-file independence that built support for their demands from their union leaders and the broader community. The women workers at Tolteca fought for bread and butter issues. They also worked to reshape their union to take on broader issues of social justice that included immigration rights and women's rights.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, this administration, the most pro-worker administration, at least of my lifetime, and I would feel safe to say the most pro-worker administration since FDR. Just throwing that out there. This has been an administration clearly on the side of working people, and I'm not surprised to see the U.S. Trade Representative Kathleen Tai and her office coming out and being very proactive and pushing this section of the USMCA, the formerly NAFTA, the new NAFTA, that was going to help Mexican workers organize and ensure that they get independent unions and have the right to collective bargaining and doing some of the things that I think we would like to have here too, but at least in a way ensuring that it happens in Mexico. And Mexico has a leader who's saying that they want that too. So this can be an interesting time. And here to share some thoughts on what exactly it is that the USMCA has done, what part of it we're talking about, and what these workers in Mexico endured, and maybe what the solution is going to be. I've asked Arthur Stamoulos to come talk with us. He's the executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Citizenstrade.org is their website. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So let's walk through this from the beginning. You had the old NAFTA, which, you know, the only labor standards in it were very toothless and easy to get around. Trump renegotiated NAFTA, and there was some good stuff on the labor front, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. The Trump administration did renegotiate NAFTA. The deal that Trump initially signed off on had a couple of good things in it, but also a ton of junk, like, you know, new monopoly rights for pharmaceutical companies that would have jacked up medicine prices, language locking in deregulation for big tech. And so at that time, labor unions, consumer groups, Democrats in Congress, others, you know, looked at that initial deal and said, no way, like this is not going to pass through Congress as written. And together we were able to force the removal of a lot of the bad language, particularly on medicines, but also were able to add new enforcement provisions that at least give us a shot at trying to enforce NAFTA's labor standards. And so, you know, that deal eventually passed. The Trump administration had the power to enforce labor standards within that revised NAFTA deal. They for whatever reason, never used those powers.
Right.
But now, less than 2 months after Joe Biden's new U.S. Trade Representative was confirmed, she already has a labor rights enforcement case going. It's one that labor unions didn't even ask her to do. She's done this on her own initiative. And so that alone is a sea change in attitude, right? Do you use trade agreements to try to help corporations get even richer? Or do you use them to try to enforce labor rights? And so, you know, this new case and other cases are going to be a good test as to how well that NAFTA revision will or will not work moving forward. When Trump was in office, he didn't even try to make it work. But now we have people in power who are interested in seeing labor rights enforced. We're just going to have to see how far they can get with the tools in place.
Now, obviously, this story is about the 6,000 workers at the GM plant in Silao. Is that how it's pronounced? Silao?
Silao.
And evidently there was an election that went on, and there's a ton of the way it was explained to me. If I thought Amazon was bad, this was 10 times worse, and Amazon was really bad. That these workers, you know, clearly lost the election because of all of the things that went on. And now they're talking about a new election, right?
Yeah. So an issue in this case and in a lot of labor rights abuses cases across Mexico is this issue of what are called protection unions, where the company will work with a corrupt union. They'll sign a contract that the workers had no say in negotiating, no say in approving whatsoever. And this has been the case in Mexico for decade after decade after decade. And under Mexican labor law now, just in the past few years, that practice is supposed to be illegal, but it's still extremely widespread. And so this particular case involves a GM plant in central Mexico that produces hundreds of thousands of the Chevy Silverado and GMC Sierra pickup trucks, you know, a huge proportion of which are shipped, you know, shipped back to the U.S. And this plant has a protection union. Under the new law, the workers there are supposed to get to vote on their contracts. And so the company, you know, essentially tried to orchestrate a rubber stamp type election, you know, to approve that contract. But they got caught. You know, first off, the more than 6,000 workers at the plant had a 15-hour window to vote. They didn't even get to see, to read the contract. It wasn't even posted online. You know, it's like, oh, we've got a contract, vote on it. You don't get to see it. Then a bunch of the ballots that the workers, you know, put in opposing the contract got destroyed, and the protection union has refused to turn in the ballots that were counted over to authorities for account verification. And stuff like this is why, you know, Mexico has wages that are actually far lower than those in China, right? I mean, it's exactly why companies like GM like to set up shop there. Worker rights are not respected. And as a result, you know, workers are paid far, far less for the same exact work that workers in the U.S., you know, and other countries are paid for. And so the Biden administration has officially filed this complaint with the Mexican government. The Mexican government has 10 days to respond. And if some agreement isn't reached to rectify the issue, the U.S. can eventually impose really heavy tariffs on the trucks coming to the U.S. from that plant. It's about a 25% tariff. So when you look at the price of a truck, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And hopefully that's enough to get some justice for the workers at this plant.
Now, if I remember right, there was something talking about like all of the auto, especially in autos, that there was like a minimum wage that had to be paid of a certain $16 pops into my head. But that seems really high for Mexican wages. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, so in the new NAFTA deal, there what's called rules of origin, which mean that the parts that go into a big product, like a truck, you know, like a car, that those parts have to be made by workers earning a certain wage. And so when it comes to a car under the new NAFTA deal, you know, in total, all the parts have to be made by workers averaging $16 an hour, which, you know, I mean, it's a good precedent to set that there should be a wage standard in there. The problem is that, you know, it's probably a pretty easy standard to meet, you know, because they throw in stuff like the design of the product, you know, like the white collar folks' wages who are getting, you know, six figure incomes averaging out with, you know, these workers in Mexico who are making far, 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 far less. You know, so I'm skeptical that that's actually going to benefit any worker in Mexico, let alone in the United States. But you know, it is an interesting precedent that we should be building off of moving forward.
I mean, it's something. I mean, at the end of the day, and this is where, you know, even when the former guy was in the White House, I said, look, the fact that he got some things into the USMCA that I don't think anyone else could have gotten, because I don't think Republicans would have ever gone along with getting rid of the tribunals and an actual some bit of labor law reform. I think, you know, I don't know that it's enough, but at least it was something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for listeners to know that the Trump administration never proposed those labor reforms. Like, labor and Democrats in Congress are the ones who fought for it. But, you know, it certainly is true. Some Republicans went along with it who probably would not have were it not for a Republican in the White House. That's absolutely the case.
Yeah. So where do you see this going? Because there is some coordination going on, as I understand, from our U.S. trade rep and the person in Mexico that she deals with. What are we looking for? What do you think? What do you think this is going to bear out?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, because there is an administration in Mexico as well that is much more labor friendly than any previous Mexican administration for many decades. And one of the big problems they face is that the state governments in Mexico are often extremely hostile to labor, that, you know, they're part and parcel of this corrupt union, protection union racket. And they don't want workers to have more power. And so the hope is that, you know, these NAFTA cases will, you know, empower those elements in Mexico that are serious about independent unions and are serious about union rights, and also will be a way to pressure the corporations like GM that have always, you know, if not worked hand in hand with these corrupt protection unions, at least look the other way to make them understand, hey, you know, if you continue this, your products are going to face tariffs, and the benefit of moving to a low wage nation like Mexico are going to be taken away from you. So, you know, there's a lot of hope right now. The labor unions in the US and Mexico have filed another case under NAFTA for auto parts workers at a Trinex plant across the border, where, you know, workers who tried to form an independent union were illegally dismissed. Their attorney was arrested on trumped up charges. You know, another good example of how worker rights abuses in other countries, you know, in Mexico, not only hurt workers there, and certainly they hurt the workers there first and foremost, but also hurt workers in the U.S. because, you know, at that company, just a few years ago, 1,600 unionized workers in an auto parts plant owned by the same company here in Pennsylvania were laid off when the company decided to move production to Mexico. And so, you know, it just shows, you know, if we want to see good jobs, better wages anywhere, we can't allow this race to the bottom in worker rights to occur. You know, and so again, for the first time ever, we have a good U.S. trade representative willing to try to address these issues. You know, hopefully the tools that she currently has under the current NAFTA pact are going to be strong enough to allow for some of that change to happen. My guess is we're going to have to fight for even better deals and better laws moving forward.
And obviously our trade deals need to be updated with labor law reform happening. And look, this is a step in the right direction. Needs to be much stronger. We need to do much more. But, you know, the fact that we're talking about giving workers in Mexico the opportunity to raise their wages, I think is a good thing, because I think it will stem some of the flight out of the country. But there's still the behemoth in the room, and that's China. And it's still a lot of other places that we've got bad trade deals with. So it's my view that, you know, this is great. It's a step, but we got a lot more to go.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, this is a trade deal, you know, with Mexico and Canada. That's it. We're offshoring jobs all around the world, in particular to China. And so, you know, if our new trade ambassador, Catherine Tai, can show, you know, number one, where these existing labor standards can be used and how they can be used, and, you know, and maybe number two, where they fall short, hopefully we can get policymakers to push for even bigger changes, you know, on a bilateral basis and then eventually globally. You know, obviously we know that there are some policymakers who are with us on this, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a fight to get workers' power. It always has been. It always will be.
Now, you know, I'm looking at this and, you know, you go really quick. We've got two cases. I can't imagine that it's going to end here. And I, you know, there potentially could be a flood of these to the point to where I think the system could completely bog down. And then we end up, you know, in the same kind of mess. No.
Well, I mean, hope, you know, it does take quite a bit of resources to file one of these cases. I mean, it's, I know that the unions who are involved in the filing that happened just this Monday, you know, spent many, many months, you know, sort of getting worker testimonials, preparing legal documents, et cetera, to make sure that they had a solid case that could be won, and that was the complaint that was filed. You know, you're absolutely right that, if these first initial tests of the system are successful, I mean, my hope is it will lead to a flood of additional cases, and some actual change in the system for working people. But, you know, you're right. I mean, the situation in Mexico, you know, is not unique. This GM plant is not unique. The Trinex plant is not unique. This is what workers across the entire economy are facing. And, you know, and the hope is that these initial cases will start to make some change.
Right. So who hears this case? I mean, you said they built these cases. Who hears the cases?
Yeah, so the U.S. the office of the U.S. Trade Representative in the White House is the first to sort of review the cases, and then if they decide there's enough here, they initiate the complaint with Mexico. Then Mexico has 10 days to respond, 45 days to you know sort of come to some sort of plan, and if the two countries can't agree on an action plan to fix the situation, then it's heard by a panel of labor rights experts from both countries. You know, one country picks some of them, the other country picks some of the others, and they make a decision on the case ultimately. So and that's the point where if there's no agreement, you start imposing tariffs.
Okay, because, you know, I'm looking at that. I'm going, you know, again, this is one of those scenarios where it really depends on who's in the White House and who's choosing those people on that panel then, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is why, you know, the Trump administration signed off on it, but they never used the power. It's interesting because Joe Biden's U.S. trade representative is actually someone who was in working for Democrats in Congress at the time and helped write many of these mechanisms. And so she knows them inside and out, and hopefully we'll be able to see them through to make actual change and get some workers some justice.
So since, I mean, this is your focus, how long is it going to be before we see the outcome in this? Because as you said, there's some pretty interesting deadlines going on. How soon before we see what the outcome of this is?
Yeah, so they call this a rapid response mechanism. I mean, it's going to take months before there's a final adjudication and final, agreement or imposition of tariffs. But if you look at some of our past trade agreements, the process actually took a decade.
Right.
So this is quite a bit faster. And the fact that, USTR has to respond to petitions within 30 days, and then if they move forward with them, Mexico has to respond within 10 days. That's quite a bit faster than what we've ever had in the past.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see how this plays out because this could be a great tool in helping to at least attempt to level the playing field. So I'm looking forward to it. But Arthur, I appreciate the time. It's always good talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
Good stuff. Arthur Stamulis, Executive Director of Citizens Trade Campaign, citizenstrade.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that workers across Paris joined students in a citywide general strike. College students had begun an occupation at the famed Sorbonne University earlier that May. These students were protesting what they saw as governmental repression in post-war France. A story by NPR, marking the 40th anniversary of the protests, described the situation in France, where women could not wear pants to work and married ones needed a husband's permission to open a bank account. Homosexuality was a crime. Factory workers could be fired at will. The news on the single TV channel required governmental approval. And the overcrowded education system was authoritarian. The students protested French leader Charles de Gaulle and the police. The addition of workers to the protest greatly increased its scope and impact. Paris and much of the country ground to a halt. President de Gaulle was able to weather the protests and keep his political power. By the end of June, most workers had returned to their jobs, but the country would never be the same. The protests of that spring became known as the Social Revolution. It was a turning point in the nation's history, and institutions from workplaces to universities would undergo a liberalization due to the protests. One of the most lasting images from the strike was a series of posters, simple designs emblazoned with the slogans and demands of those involved. One such poster called people to strike, declaring, "Working now is working with a gun to your head." Another read simply, "Factories, universities, union."
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you know how all we've been hearing the last week, at least the last week, is that employers can't find employees because they're lazy. And because Joe Biden has given them money and they're greedy. So lazy, greedy people don't want to go back to work for crummy wages. And understand, the places that are screaming the most are the ones who are in the fast food industry, in the hospitality industry, bars and restaurants. You know, the people who are paying crummy wages before the pandemic, you know, the ones who were paying poverty wages then. Well, the story now, headline blaring across over at Reuters, desperate for workers, U.S. restaurants and stores raise pay. And you go, about damn time. Good. It needed to happen. So the pandemic did anything? Maybe it boosted wages a little bit, and that's a good thing. Now, some other things I think the employers can be doing, helping us make sure that all of us get vaccinated. And here, share some thoughts on how employers can help do that. I've asked Emily G to come talk with us. She is a senior economist for health policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So as a senior economist, you got to be looking at the pay raises going, yeah, this is how this works. You need workers. There's a shortage of workers. You sweeten the pot a little bit so that they come. It seems like common sense.
Exactly. That's how the market's supposed to work. One other thing that employers need to think about, too, is making sure that workers feel safe at work. We're only about a third vaccinated nationwide. And so employers can do a lot more to make sure that, that their communities get vaccinated, but their workers are safe too, especially when with today's news that vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks indoors.
Yep. No. And yesterday I talked a little bit about this story in Arizona where this golf cart company offered the employees who got vaccinated an extra dollar an hour in their paycheck. And the people who didn't get vaccinated, they were losing their minds because they felt like they were, well, we don't get it. Of course you don't get it because you're not protecting yourself. And then the question came up of, well, why would employers want their workers vaccinated outside of just the common sense of lower healthcare costs? Hey, we want our customers safe too. I'm curious your thoughts.
Sure. So protecting yourself is certainly part of it, right? We know that people who are vaccinated have a far lower rate of getting sick at all, a very small chance, compared to people who are unvaccinated of getting very sick. And the vaccine also prevents people from dying of COVID. But it's not just about ourselves. It's also about protecting our communities and protecting our coworkers at work, protecting our clients or customers if we're, in the workplace where we're face-to-face with other people, including people who might not be able to be vaccinated because they're kids or because they have, religious or, health reasons to not get vaccinated. So it's, it's important for health and it's also important for business. People will feel safer at work when they, when the community is protected. And people will feel better about going out and being consumers too if they know that their chance of catching the coronavirus from the community is much lower.
Now, the thing that gets me is, I've had these conversations with, as someone who's, a member of a labor union and actually, does some work with labor unions, this question comes up of what if you have members who don't want to get vaccinated? How do you deal with that? What should the company, what responsibility does the company have? Can the company force them to do it? How do you see going forward this question playing out? Because look, we know there's going to be at least 25% of us who are stupid enough to go, no, we're never going to do it because, there could be Bill Gates, putting chips in our arms or aliens or whoever, whatever theory they come up with. You're going to get those recalcitrant people who are going to say this anyway. So you got to deal with them. How do employers deal with them, do you think?
So there are a variety of reasons why people don't get vaccinated or don't want to get vaccinated. And I think it's important for employers to consider why that is. So there are some people who respond to surveys saying that, they want to get it right away. I think that's, there are increasingly resources out there to get the vaccine at retail pharmacies and community health centers. There are also, people who are want to wait and see because they're concerned about the side effects, they're concerned about needing to miss work in order to just get the vaccine, or because they might need to take time off to recover. And there are some people who don't want to get it at all, and you know, maybe they just need to know more information about the risks of COVID or the benefits of the vaccine.
Come on, Emily. I think you're giving them way too much credit. There are people who, no matter what fact you lay in front of them, no matter how much common sense you make, no matter what you say, never going to do it. Never.
Sure. So I will get there. But I think, you know, before we deal with those types of folks, I think we still have a ways to go, and employers need to step it up to make sure that people who are hesitant, you know, are truly hesitant and whose minds can be changed, have better access, including things like paid leave for both the vaccination recovery, and have know where to get the vaccine. If you're someone who speaks Spanish or, you know, doesn't have internet access at home, or works hours that, you know, that mean that you aren't, you know, able to go get the vaccine during business hours, it can be hard to get the vaccine. So there's a lot that employers can do to increase access.
Right.
That said, you know, I think there are some categories of employers that need to seriously consider mandating the vaccine for both worker safety and public safety. So, for example, I think healthcare facilities is an obvious one. We have had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die in nursing homes during the pandemic. But maybe also, you know, high density workplaces like meatpacking plants, where people are literally working elbow to elbow and can't safely social distance.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that kept coming up is, you know, because, you know, what do you do with them then if they just absolutely refuse? Do you fire them? And as a union guy, I'm like, no, I don't think you should be able to fire them. But do you make them wear masks and all of that stuff? You know, I'm curious, you as the health policy expert, what do you do with those folks who, no matter what you're going to say or do, you know, what's the path?
So I think vaccine requirements are something that firms will need to seriously consider. You know, that said, I think we shouldn't just assume that these people are never going to get vaccinated. Both unions and employers and local and state government need to be working very hard to make sure that people have good information. Because when people don't understand, you know, there's a lot of disinformation out there, right? So we need to make sure that people have good resources, can get their questions answered by people they trust, which includes, you know, peers in their community. It could be religious leaders. It could be physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals. We need to make sure that people have all the information and access that they need.
I look at a state like Ohio, who they're having a lottery. There are going to be five people over the next several weeks who are going to be lucky millionaires for simply going and doing what, for I think most people, is just common sense. I look at West Virginia; they're handing out, I guess, what is it, $100 savings bonds. I've heard of places, you know, giving out whiskey and all kinds of incentives. Are you in favor of the incentives?
I love the creativity. I think it's fantastic. I think, you know, New Orleans is giving away a pound of crawdads. Maine's giving away hunting and fishing licenses. If that's what it takes, so be it. I think any way we can get people to get vaccinated is great.
Now, obviously, you're the health policy expert here, and you know, to talk about the facts, the vaccine is very safe. I mean, in fact, you know, they stopped using the J&J shot because, you know, what was it at the time? 20 women developed some kind of blood clot that they had to figure out, so they stopped it for everybody. So it was so safe that you couldn't even get it because out of, what was it, 7-8 million, 20 people had this reaction.
That's right. The vaccines have, you know, been through rigorous trials in order to even get the authorization from the FDA. You know, these are placebo-controlled trials where half the people are given the vaccine and half aren't. Not only are the vaccines extremely safe, but they also dramatically lower the risk of getting COVID-19. Far above the, you know, the minimum threshold that the FDA set out at the beginning of the pandemic.
Now, you have the folks over there on Fox News, a couple of them anyway, saying, well, we don't know, Emily, we don't know what the long-term side effects are. And we don't know, but as of this moment, you know, we've had a year of people getting this vaccine almost. You know, anything?
Yeah, we still know they're safe. So you got to remember that even though the vaccines were approved, or they're authorized for the general population only late in 2020, the trials for the vaccine began over a year ago, which means that there are some people out there who've had the, you know, Moderna or J&J or Pfizer shot for a year or more. And we know that they're very safe and they're very effective. We also know that there are long-term, side effects of having COVID-19, aside from the acute respiratory distress that a lot of people were in with, being in the hospital on a ventilator. We also are seeing people who months or a year later are still suffering from fatigue or circulatory problems or other types of health issues because they had COVID.
So in your article, and I hope folks will take a look at it, employers can accelerate COVID-19 vaccination efforts over at the AmericanProgress.org website, and we'll get links out on how folks can take a look at that. You go through 10 ways that employers can support COVID-19 vaccination. You say improving access. Obviously, we want, I was saying, look, we've got blood mobiles that will come to your workplace and siphon blood out of you while, they can now do the other thing, I think. We can send ice cream trucks around and do it if we had to.
Right. And I think these are things that, we framed the paper around what employers could do, but it could be any private sector organization or public institution or even unions, right? I talked to some union leaders who said that they were helping arrange for clinics because employees tend to trust the union. Unions could play, help make sure that information is available in break rooms. They could arrange for, Q&A sessions with members. And so I think there are things that all of us can do to step up and ensure that everybody has access to the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to easy access, as you guys talk about, information, obviously. Mm-hmm. And again, in your article, you talk about incentives, the discounts, the lottery winnings. And of course, then you're saying you got to require and you got to verify it. So are you talking about, everyone's going to have their passports or their cards or their tattoos across the forehead or whatever?
So I think increasingly, as we see people offering, organizations offering incentives, and businesses requiring vaccination, maybe perhaps in lieu of masking and other measures or, just to show up at work, there will be popping up some credentialing systems. We're seeing private sector companies fill the gap. I think notably New York has created a state phone app that you can use to show you're vaccinated. I think these are all sort of organically happening and necessary given the incentives and requirements that we have right now. That said, I hope that employers and firms that are creating these apps ensure that people who don't have digital access are able to access apps, that they're accessible for people with disabilities, and also that they safeguard consumer privacy.
Right. Now, as a health expert, what place do we have to get to before this is in the rearview mirror? I know there's talk of 75% before we hit herd immunity. Not too long ago, you had the CDC and some other folks saying, we're just not going to get there. They don't believe that's going to happen, that COVID is going to be with us for a very long time. I'm curious your thoughts and opinions.
So there are numbers out there for, so-called herd immunity, but I think the real message is that the more, the better. So if we could get to 70 or 80%, that'd be fantastic. That said, there's no reason to give up just because we're still only at 35% vaccinated. If we could get to say 50 or 60%, which is where Israel and the UK are, we would probably see a similar trend in cases and deaths that they have, which is that, deaths are down to near zero and cases drop dramatically as more of the population got vaccinated.
Now, we don't see the stories every day on the news anymore, but we still have like 700 people who die every day and thousands of people are being infected every day, right?
This is not over yet. That's absolutely right. In fact, most of the counties in the United States are still at a high or substantial level of community transmission, according to the CDC definition. So, it's important that we keep, even though some people are vaccinated, we keep doing things like wearing masks indoors where the transmission is high. I think that's important for protecting workers. Yeah. Who will be going to work and, might not have a way of verifying whether people in the store or the restaurant are actually vaccinated or not.
Yeah. My plan is, and I'm curious your thought as an expert, this summer, I'm taking my kids, we're going to go to a couple of concerts. In the fall, I plan on, attending a football game or two. We plan on kind of trying to go back to what life was normally like. But we're still going to, when we go to these places, going to wear the mask, because it seems like common sense to me. Do you think it's safe to go into those environments?
So, you know, a lot of this is going to be going forward being is going to be individual decisions about tolerance for risk. You know, I think a lot of it's going to depend on what your local area looks like. Are there a lot of cases? Are people vaccinated? I think folks should weigh that in their decisions. And then it's also, you know, a personal preference. So for myself, I've got two young kids who for whom the vaccine is not available yet. So, you know, I'm looking forward to going to, say, outdoor baseball games this summer, but won't be taking them indoors to restaurants or museums until, you know, the community transmission is much, much lower. You know, would want them to wear masks in the instances where we do go indoors.
So let me ask you this, you know, as the mother of small children, if, you know, because Tucker Carlson said that's child abuse and someone should come in and put you in your place and call Child Protective Services on you for having the audacity to put a mask on a child. Any thoughts?
I think that not having kids wear masks when the level of community transmission is high is irresponsible. You know, I love my kids and I want them to be safe and healthy. I think one thing I've learned through the pandemic is kids are just amazingly resilient and adaptable, and they, you know, go grab their masks every time we go out. And, you know, I think it's peace of mind for all of us to know that they can play around close to other kids and go to school, but also be safe.
It's so nice of you. I mean, my first thought was F Tucker Carlson. And if I find him, if he came up and gave me a hard time, I'd smack him, but that's just me. you know, and there's just me and my kids. I very, very different way of handling it. But Emily, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some of your expertise and some of your thoughts. Hope folks will take a look at the article, Employers Can Accelerate COVID-19 Vaccination Efforts, over at AmericanProgress.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can take a look at that. Emily, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Same. Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Good stuff. No, and look, you know, for me, this is simple. We're almost through it. Little common sense, little sanity. Don't rush into things. But you know, if you're in a crowd, wear the mask. I think the information by the CDC said today, you know, if you're vaccinated, you know, it's okay. It's okay. Just a little bit of common sense and a little courtesy of others. Just my thoughts. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1998. And if you tried to catch a cab in New York City on that particular day, you probably did not have much luck. The city's yellow cab drivers held a one-day strike to protest Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's new taxi cab regulations. 90% of the city's more than 12,000 taxi cabs stayed parked on that day. 2,000 cabs lined up along 14th Street and Avenue D in a demonstration of strength and a sign of solidarity. It was the first taxi driver's strike in New York City in 30 years. The strike was led by the National Taxi Workers Alliance and their founder, Haravi Desai. After 15 years of trying to organize, the taxi drivers had just founded their union that February. The union represented workers from 85 countries, as many of the cab drivers were immigrants. The New York Times reported that city officials were stunned by the success of the strike. The one-day action showed the solidarity of the taxi drivers' union. Today, the Taxi Workers Alliance represents 200,000 taxi drivers who provide an estimated 1 billion rides each year to New Yorkers and tourists. One New York taxi driver expressed the union's importance, saying, "With my union, I get the spiritual boost and the inspiration to overcome the obstacles in my track. I am a member of the AFL-CIO. It's a great feeling." Unionization is important for taxi drivers. They often have to pay steep fees for their medallion to operate their cabs, and fluctuating fuel costs can eat into their profits. Rideshare programs such as Uber are further eroding cab drivers' livelihoods. Organizing workers like cab drivers, car wash workers, and service employees is an important front for today's labor movement.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us at Labor History in 2.